supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. In recent years, there have been several high-profile incidents in Philadelphia of people leaving their homes and returning to find them occupied by others that they don't know. When the strangers claim they have a right to be there, the legal battle that ensues can take months or even years, during which the homeowners are forced to find another place to stay. Stories like this prompt shock and outrage, and for the past 9 months, Philadelphia City Councilman David O. has been warning of an increasing number of squatters and criminal trespassers plaguing the city's homeowners. Today, a bill he's been promoting since September finally passed out of committee, but opponents argue it endangers renters and gives false hope to property owners. Jake Blumgard of WHYY's Plan Philly reports.
Mary Jo Potts has been a realtor in Philadelphia for 30 years, with an emphasis on the sale of vacant properties. In the past 2 years, she says there have been a rash of incidents where people break into empty buildings and set up homes there.
Walk up to the property one day, and there's somebody in there. They have a fake lease, so we can't do anything about it. The people who rightfully own these houses do not have any rights.
Actually, homeowners do have recourse, but they sometimes have to fight in court for months to kick out trespassers. Councilman O says his bill will prompt the police and the courts to get them help faster. Opponents say they support the intent of O's legislation, but that the bill is sloppily written and would allow unscrupulous landlords to avoid the standard eviction process. Councilwoman Sherelle Parker is leading the charge against O's bill, arguing that the way he defines squatters is broad to the point of meaninglessness.
I'm really concerned that the definition of criminal and defiant trespasser could lead to innocent victims.
Phil Lord of the Tenants Union said the bill would do little to help those dealing with squatters. He also questioned whether City Council had the legal authority to tell the courts and the police department how to conduct their internal procedures.
I'm going to be brief because I don't see how this legislation helps anybody. Because all it really does is say, okay, the police have to be do what the police do, which they do anyway. The courts have to go forward and provide better procedures. They're working on that already, and we can't tell them what to do about that, so that's not very constructive.
But Councilman O stood his ground, insisting that he was simply promoting law and order.
The issue that this bill presents is simply this: get in front of the proper judge faster.
The bill passed out of committee, but its fate before the full council and with Mayor Kenney is unclear. In the meantime, a new task force has been formed to find non-legislative solutions. Jake Blumgart, WHYY News.
This month, the U.S. Supreme Court is expected to deliver decisions on two cases involving partisan gerrymandering, one from Wisconsin, the other from Maryland. Keystone Crossroads' Lindsay Lazarski reports on how these highly anticipated decisions from the High Court may affect Pennsylvania, which recently overturned its congressional map.
How much politics is too much when it comes to drawing the boundaries of a voting district? That's a central question in two cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. In the past, the court has said it's a question it couldn't answer. Here's the late Justice Antonin Scalia in 2004.
All of the standards that have been proposed to date are unmanageable, indiscernible, or both.
But what if this time around the court does find a standard for when a state legislature goes too far? What would that mean for Pennsylvania? Russell Wheeler, a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institute, says in the short term, not much.
Whatever it comes out, I don't think it's going to have much of an impact on the Pennsylvania situation.
Earlier this year, the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court delved into the question of how much is too much and gave an answer. It declared the congressional map an illegal partisan gerrymander and ordered a new one that dramatically altered the state's political landscape. That was a state court decision based on the state constitution, and the U.S. Supreme Court refused to get involved in the Pennsylvania fight. And even if it rules in the Wisconsin or Maryland cases, it's not expected to affect the new Pennsylvania map. Mimi McKenzie, legal director at the Public Interest Law Center, represents the plaintiffs in the Pennsylvania case.
We're pretty well set up, you know, in Pennsylvania, at least for now, no matter how this U.S. Supreme Court decision comes down.
She's hopeful that the U.S. Supreme Court will uphold the lower court's ruling that districts in Wisconsin were unconstitutional. Like in many cases, she says the decision will come down to Justice Anthony Kennedy, often the swing vote.
I would like to see voters in Pennsylvania have multiple avenues for pursuing a claim that a particular map violates either the Pennsylvania Constitution or the U.S. Constitution. But, you know, at the same time, I take some comfort if Justice Kennedy does not come through for voters, that at least in Pennsylvania, under our Pennsylvania Constitution, we still have the ability to protect voters.
Even after the Pennsylvania ruling, some are still unsettled over the question of how much partisan politics is permissible in the state. GOP defendants in the case still maintain they followed the rule of law at the time the map was drawn back in 2011.
People can say we made really ugly shapes, but that is a radically different perspective in my head than saying we violated the law.
Drew Crompton is chief of staff for Senate Pro Tem Joe Scarnati. His position from the beginning was to delay the Pennsylvania case until the ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court. And he's still looking for clarity from the high court.
What I don't want is a subjective standard that leads us into a huge parade of additional litigation.
It remains to be seen how deep the U.S. Supreme Court will wade into these issues, says Nate Persley, a redistricting expert and Stanford law professor. He was the one appointed by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to advise in redrawing its districts earlier this year. Although he wouldn't speak directly about the Pennsylvania case, he says in the long term, decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court on partisan gerrymandering will have ripple effects across the nation, especially after the 2020 census, when all states will be redrawing their congressional maps.
This could lead to full employment for redistricting lawyers, as well as a significant amount of litigation in the states. And it could also, you know, reset the rules for fair representation in the country.
Even if the high court doesn't come up with a clear and precise standard, Persley says the court may still police the most egregious cases. Lindsay Lazarski, Keystone Crossroads.
Last month, parents and activists sued New Jersey, claiming its public schools have become so segregated they violate the state's constitution. Rutgers researcher Elana Arnold-Berkowitz has been thinking about school segregation for a while, and earlier this year, she came up with an idea that she hopes will help address the problem. Not through the courts, but through a tweak to the college admissions process. She sat down with WHYY education reporter Avi Wolfman-Aaron to explain her idea, and she started by describing segregation as an economic problem. Wealthy families, she said, cluster in wealthy districts, drawn by the promise of high-performing schools and ultimately college success for their kids. In other words, they have an economic incentive to live together.
Districts are becoming, especially New Jersey, which is what I'm most familiar with, are becoming even less and less integrated. Money runs away from less money or from poverty. And so to integrate, you're going to have to change that.
Traditionally, the way that people have tried to change it is to either force or move students in such a way that the K-12 schools are integrated in a mandated way. Mm-hmm. Busing is the most common example, right? But that is not what this idea is about.
Right. So you can often see that when something is mandated, the issue is the people with the money have the power to get around the mandate, to make it no longer occur. We're going to vote you out. We're going to, and other pressures, or pay their way out. I'm going to buy a house somewhere else.
Or go to a private school.
Or go to a private school. So you end up with all these ways that those who have the money and the power to have a choice run their money away from integration. So what is needed is a market force that then makes it desirable to integrate.
So you're sitting there thinking, all these market forces are working against integration. Mm-hmm. And when you mandate integration, it creates crazy backlash. What can we do? And that thought leads you where?
So that leads you to, well, what do wealthy people want? And the answer is often what their goal of education is to have their kid end up at a quote-unquote good college. So if you can use that as a market force to incentivize integration, then you can dampen some of these market forces that are very strongly promoting segregation.
What's the idea?
So the idea is that to incentivize voluntary integration, K-12 schools, so kindergarten through 12th grade schools, serving economically disadvantaged students, had a tangible benefit of their own that they could offer. And that would be bonus points towards admissions to selective colleges.
The notion is that the college would offer an admissions boost to someone attending a school with a certain threshold of students receiving free and reduced lunch. Is that the framework we're working with, or is it more flexible than that? What's the sort of concrete idea at this point?
My perspective is you're really actually trying to incentivize people moving into as low income a school as possible from the wealthy side. And you want to pull the wealth as deeply into the lower income side to make integration actually happen. The way it should work is actually a increasing scale of points as income of the student body decreases, the bonus points increase.
It would seem that over time the losers would be school districts and schools that are highly segregated and have high concentrations of wealth. People buy into those communities at a high price, and you would be devaluing somewhat their purchase.
So I think that's true to the extent probably that they've purchased almost at the peak of the market. It would probably revalue them to before the hype started for their district. So I guess while it could be seen as a loss, I think of it more as a correction. My thinking has kind of always realized that the economic systems have been kind of unfairly penalizing, I mean, tremendously unfairly penalizing Black and Hispanic families, and maintaining this inequity that we're seeing represented in our school demographics. I feel like the core piece that has always been there has been the economics of it. And so this was one way that the economics can kind of be tricked.
Rutgers University researcher Alana Arnold-Berkovitz speaking with WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt. One man's experience at a West Philadelphia Lowe's has the home improvement store reviewing its practice of verifying customer purchases on the way out the door. WHYY's Annette John Hall reports that the man felt like a criminal after leaving the store and dug deeper into which customers have their receipts checked and which customers don't.
Will Mega spent the better part of Memorial Day weekend going back and forth to Lowe's, purchasing items for a home improvement project. Each time, he was required to show his receipt at the exit, even though the cashier stand where he purchased his items was just a few feet away.
If you stopped me because I was stealing something, stop me all day. I get it, but there was no probable cause.
In a heated video exchange, Mega insists that the manager show him the receipt policy. The manager tells him not to take it personally, that the practice is in place because the store, located on 50th Street in the Parkside section of West Philadelphia, is designated a, quote, Class 6 or high theft store.
It's a Class 6 store, sir.
What's that mean?
Class 6 means for, it's a high theft store, essentially.
Oh, high theft store. So I'm being treated like a criminal because somebody else committed a crime.
I'm not saying you're...
Listen, you're treating me, a customer who paid for my goods,
right.
like a criminal.
When Mega asks if the practice occurs only in inner city neighborhoods, an employee nods her head yes. When he needed paint, he went to a store in Havertown where no one checked his receipts. Temple business professor Jeffrey Bowles says he has not seen any research on how receipt check upon exit reduces crime and says the practice raises a question of racial profiling.
I wonder why the store is implementing this specific loss prevention tactic as opposed to others. Why it would be requiring customers to go through this extra step. And it's not being applied in a consistent way across other stores.
Mega, who is a dean of students at a North Philadelphia charter school, says he'd like to see a universal policy implemented so no Lowe's customer will be stopped and asked for a receipt.
Just because others may have committed a crime, I should not be treated like a criminal. That's just not fair. It just leaves open... Too many possibilities to discriminate against people.
In a statement provided to WHYY, Lowe says it's reevaluating its practice and has, quote, reached out to Mr. Mega to understand more about his experience and continue the dialogue. Annette John Hall, WHYY News.
Since the incident at Starbucks, more and more people of color have been coming forward with their own stories of being unfairly profiled at stores. Nakia Presley says she was singled out while shopping at a major grocery chain in the Oxford Circle section of Philadelphia. Presley picked up and paid for her blood pressure medication at the store pharmacy and turned to leave. She describes what happened next.
And as I was exiting the door, a Caucasian lady come running to me, telling me to give her the hoagie. I'm looking at her crazy, like, what hoagie? The bag of medicine was like an all-white bag. She said, the hoagie's over there under your arm. I would pull the bag out. It's actually medicine. And, you know, she's looking crazy and, okay. You know, that was embarrassing when customers is entering the store and exiting the store and now watching me argue and debate with this lady about a bag, and at the end of the day when she sees the bag, it's not a hoagie that she was accusing me of stealing, it's my medicine.
You can read more personal stories in our series Not Just Starbucks at WHYY.org. 1 week into the unofficial summer season, let's take out the calendar with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, let me see here, 17 days out from June 21st, what happens then?
Well, right now we're at 14 hours, 52 minutes day length, and the rate at which we're gaining daylight now is slowing dramatically. When we get to that point, the Earth will reach a point in its orbit around the Sun in which the North Pole of the Earth has the greatest amount of tilt toward the Sun. And what that does for us is that gives us the greatest amount of daylight for the Northern Hemisphere. And that's because as the Earth tilts toward the Sun, what we see on the Earth is that the arc of the Sun's path across the sky gets to its greatest length. That's what gives us these long days, if you will, or greatest number of hours of daylight. So we're slowly drifting toward that, but the amount of daylight gain between now and when we get to the summer solstice is slowing dramatically. So we're at about 59 seconds tomorrow, but then the day after we lose 3 seconds, so it's only 56 that we gain. And for the next 17 days, it's about that 3 seconds until we end up at the point where we're gaining no more time. And the very next day, June 22nd, we lose 3 seconds of daylight. So you can really see why you might call what we think of as the first day of summer midsummer instead, because we're no longer gaining minutes of daylight.
As for that tilt, how close are we in the Philadelphia region to being able to view the sun directly overhead?
Well, you would think that because we're coming to that point, it might work that way. But if you look on a globe, you'll notice there are two lines adjacent to the equator. One is above the equator, one is below the equator, and they're described as tropics, the Tropic of Capricorn and the Tropic of Cancer. Well, the Tropic of Cancer is the one we're interested in. It's a line that's 23.5 degrees above the equator, and it's at that point along that line where the sun is directly above an observer. Now, for us, we're all the way up here at 40 degrees north, so we're way off of that. But if you were in the town of Georgetown on the island of Exuma in the Bahamas, on that day at noon, you would find the sun directly overhead. And all territories around the planet along that line of latitude, they all will experience the sun directly overhead at noon on the day when the sun reaches its highest noon point in the sky.
Say, Derek, eight planets. Do we have an approximate count of how many moons have been identified in our solar system?
Well, indeed we do. In our solar system, we're now officially counting 175 moons orbiting eight planets. But researchers from the University of California at Riverside and University of Queensland have identified 121 exoplanets that have orbits in their star's habitable zone, that region where water can exist as a liquid, that distance where it can exist as a liquid, that could have large enough moons that might be capable of supporting life.
Could have, but they're too small and too far away at this juncture to be able to positively identify them.
We can't see the moons. We suspect that they might exist because one of the things we're beginning to learn about exoplanets is they could have moons large enough. Once we develop the technologies to be able to detect those, we can get a little bit further down the path of whether or not there's any possibility at all of life.
We have a moment left. With clear skies, what's available to be seen in the night sky this week?
So now we're coming into this really wonderful planetary observing season. In the evening, just after sunset, we can see Venus over on the western side of the sky and Jupiter over on the eastern side of the sky, both well up above the horizon, so they're easy to spot. And of course, remember, stars twinkle, planets don't, and these will be the first objects you'll see in the evening sky as the sky gets darker. Now, just after midnight, Saturn and Mars then take over the sky, predominantly on the eastern side. But at that point, we'll have in the evening sky Jupiter, Saturn, and Mars. That's just after midnight. Saturn, conveniently, hangs right above the main one of the main constellations of the summer sky, Sagittarius. And the moon is in its late phases right now. We can keep in mind that this Wednesday, the moon reaches last quarter.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Delaware is set to become the first state in the nation to allow full-scale sports betting since the Supreme Court opened it up to all states last month. And tomorrow evening, we'll look at how sports betting could impact the first state. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.